How significant are the crimes of the Clinton Foundation? Could Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations be in peril even if she does secure the presidency? What evidence is there that the Hillary Clinton campaign secured the Democratic nomination through election rigging? Could there be any substance to Donald Trump's claims of election fraud and media bias? And why are black Americans apparently drawn to the Clintons in spite of a record in power which has been hostile to that population? On this week's Global Research News Hour, recorded days before Americans head for the ballot box, we report on the election campaign with a special focus on the record of the nominee widely favored to win, Hillary Clinton. We'll speak with investor and writer Charles Ortel about his investigation into the Clinton Foundation's record of criminality. We'll check in with indie media commentator Debbie Lusignan, a.k.a. Sane Progressive, about the demonstrable election and media fraud she has tracked during both the Democratic nomination race and the race for president. And finally, we hear from Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, about the Clinton family's appeal to and abuse of America's black population. On this week's program, Fraud and Corruption, Probing the Clinton Record. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 4th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Moscow State University political science professor and co-chairman of the National Security Council of Russia, Sergei Markov, believes a decisive battle to liberate Aleppo looms, saying, quote, "I think that the Russian, Iranian, and Syrian foreign ministers discussed the issue during their recent meeting in Moscow. I believe that the operations to regain Aleppo will kick off on November 7th or 8th, before Obama leaves power, and it will be a blow to the U.S. president by Vladimir Putin before his departure," unquote. An unnamed Western intelligence source believes Russia is, quote, "on the brink of a major military assault on Aleppo," unquote. If so, expect resumption of aerial operations suspended for 16 days. A November surprise, coinciding with American elections when U.S. public attention awaits their results. That comes from the article, "Is Putin Planning a November Surprise in Aleppo, Coinciding with U.S. Elections?" by Stephen Lendman, posted November 3rd. 20 years ago, the U.S. had the economic leverage to sustain the neoliberal policies of the Washington Consensus throughout Latin America. Today, the U.S. continues to pursue policies based on anachronistic power relations, seeming to ignore the fact that China is now a world power and a viable economic trade and investment alternative, successfully competing for markets and influence in Asia. Washington is failing to compete in that marketplace and, therefore, can no longer rely on docile client state. Washington cannot effectively control and direct large-scale capital flows to shore up its newly installed rightist regimes in Argentina and Brazil as they crumble under their own corruption and incompetence. Meanwhile, the world is watching a domestic U.S. economy mired in stagnation, with its own political elites torn by corruption and scandals at the highest level and staging the most bizarre presidential campaign in its history. That comes from the article, "Wall Street and the Pentagon, Premature Political and Military Ejaculations," by Professor James Petras, posted November 3rd. CETA is an agreement that reflects all that was negative about NAFTA. It provides the promise that further agreements, TTIP and TTP, will provide the same investor dispute mechanism that supersedes national sovereignty. It further disenfranchises the average citizen while enriching and empowering the corporate elite, again, promising more for the future. It displays all the hollow rhetoric that is manipulated through the media, generally meaningless, undefined platitudes without context or reference to the realities of existing agreements. The Trudeau government is simply reinforcing the Harper government that preceded it, using essentially the same verbiage, but somehow with a kinder, gentler persona. That comes from the article, The EU-Canada Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, Backroom Ministrations and Secret Negotiations, by Jim Miles, posted November 3rd. JASTA, argued Theodore Karasik, would also permit Saudi citizens an avenue to sue the U.S. government and its employees in foreign courts. That would well accompany additional moves to amend domestic laws, quote, to allow their citizens to sue the U.S. government and its employees in foreign courts, most likely state security courts, unquote. Stephen I. Vladek of the University of Texas School of Law goes further in suggesting that the law will do little to bring home the litigious bounty for victims of 9/11, while enlarging the scope for U.S. plaintiffs to launch suits against states for international terrorism, whether Washington deems them sponsors of terrorism or otherwise. The punch against U.S. power, however, would come in the form of taking Washington's policies to task in very specific cases. Would, for instance, the Syrian regime be justified in suing the United States for its role in sponsoring Syrian rebel fighters who go on to commit acts of terrorism? That comes from the article, Suing Saudi Arabia for its alleged role in 9/11, Overturning Sovereign Immunity in U.S. Courts, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted November 3rd. This week could well be remembered as South Africa's most important political inflection point since the September 2008 ousting of sitting President Thabo Mbeki by his own party, the African National Congress. His main tormentor then was Jacob Zuma, who, following a brief handover period, has ruled the country in an increasingly dubious manner since May 2009. But several contradictions have exploded in Zuma's face. Political opponents from across the spectrum, radical university students, and his own party's establishment smell the blood as Zuma's fabled patronage system is now in the spotlight, apparently in tatters. Zuma just suffered two major legal defeats, a fumbled state attack on Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, which was humiliatingly withdrawn by an incompetent prosecutor on Monday following a national outcry, and Wednesday's release of the Public Protector's State of Capture report on the Zuma family's corrupt relationships, a report the president and two cabinet colleagues unsuccessfully attempt to quash. That comes from the article, South Africa's Deprivations and Depravations Revealed in Jacob Zuma's Meltdown, by Professor Patrick Bond, posted November 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. A pattern is clearly emerging of criminal activity within the Clinton campaign that cannot easily be dismissed with pivots to Russian hacking or Donald Trump's bullying and sexist behavior. This week, the Global Research News Hour investigates what is publicly known about the Clinton record. We start by looking at the Clinton Foundation and its odious activities. Charles Ortel has been scrutinizing the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation since February of 2015. His research reveals a pattern of massive fraud through questionable and illegal practices which has enriched the Clintons at the expense of the works the foundation was purportedly set up to perform. Charles Ortel is a former Wall Street banker, having been a managing director at Dillon Reed and Newport Value Partners, and private financial investor. He'd received his BA from Yale and an MBA from Harvard Business School. In 2007, he became a whistleblower and was instrumental in bringing down General Electric after revealing GE's fraudulently overvaluing its stock by many billions of dollars to mislead its investors. He joins us now to discuss the foundation in the context of the presidential election race. Charles Ortel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my honor to be on your show.
Could you share with our listeners how this foundation was formed and how it came to be engaged with foreign countries and foreign policy initiatives?
Well, that's a great question. So under American law, there's not only general law pertaining to setting up charities and to setting up private foundations, but there's a statute that has to do with the setting up of presidential foundations, and those are meant, in fact, to be archives that house the records and, you know, the pictures and photos and now emails that a president will create during his tenure in a building where people can study those archives. And when you go back into the history of the Clinton Foundation, you see that it's very clear this was supposed to be a narrowly circumscribed foundation based in Little Rock, Arkansas, focused upon what Bill did during his presidency from 1993 to 2001. And what happened here is that as Bill exited the White House, there was a very controversial pardon where he pardoned Mark Rich and actually some other people, and that created a furor and led to congressional investigations. So the big money donors weren't interested in supporting this effort. Just at about the time that they began to break ground on building this vast complex. So what's come out now is that they needed to have a sexier set of objectives to attract the kind of big money that foundations get from governments, as you say, from wealthy foundations around the world. And there was this sloppy transition, sloppy in the sense that under our laws, U.S. laws are perhaps different than Canadian and other laws, you can't just, you know, solicit money and get authorized to be a presidential foundation, receive the equivalent of a driver's license, and then take that foundation to any other purpose you decide. The IRS is very strict. This foundation was supposed to focus on domestic matters in Little Rock, but by 2001-2, in the name of the foundation, people around Bill Clinton began to solicit money for a whole host of causes. And they basically have never gotten the paperwork right. Down here, we have over 1 million charities, of which this would be one. The IRS, our taxing authority, does not have the resources to regulate all these, nor do the individual states have the resources to regulate particularly a charity that might operate internationally. And so this thing started going all over the world, doing all sorts of things that it wasn't supposed to do, including mixing, as I think the WikiLeaks emails show, illegal private gain purposes, which are strictly prohibited, and as well, illegal political purposes. The staff of the foundation included people who were longtime political operatives for the Clintons, and I think we're going to find as time passes that the lines were blurred, that the Democrat Party, one of the key trustees of the Clinton Foundation was chairman of the Democratic Party, Terry McAuliffe, and a force behind the Clintons. The Democratic Party began to see this foundation as a way to raise money. And to now answer your question, in our country, it is strictly forbidden for foreign governments to finance political campaigns. And where I think the Clinton Foundation has been doing its level best to obscure the degree to which foreign governments passed money into the foundation at crucial periods when either Hillary was running for Senate or running for re-election or when we had a big presidential campaign. Now, I would point out, I understand that there's a Canadian connection here. Mm. Your own Canadian government was a big funder, it seems, judging by recent revelations in the press and a book by Joe Connison. In the 2003-4-5 period, roughly, your government started giving substantial sums that were sent in the direction of the foundation, in theory, to fight HIV/AIDS around the world. Now, this foundation was never authorized to do that. They did not, indeed, have the controls required to do that effectively. And recent research in the last several months has shown without doubt that it's likely this foundation procured medicine that was adulterated, medicine provided by a drug company called Ranbaxy in India. This is a textbook case in how not to organize a charity, how not to operate a charity, and how not to defend a charity from engaging in illegal related party transactions that either create private gains for insiders, a crime called enormement, or allow the charity to be engaged illegally in political activities. This is a rogue charity operated in the name of a former president of the United States and an aspiring president of the United States.
Now, there's a particular, with the HIV initiative, there's a particularly egregious bit of business that happened, I think, over the course of 2008, in which there were funds that were taken that were intended for a fund program, and it ended up being overspent, but the Clintons ended up collecting that money, and then they were able to cover it up through through creation of an endowment.
That's a sordid tale, and I'm a little bit familiar. There's a law firm up in Canada called Blumberg, Blumberg, that is has a practice focusing on philanthropy, has written some excellent memos. Your laws up in Canada are super strict, and the crime that you're just discussing, it's a multi-level crime. In the first instance, the entity that you're talking about, Clinton...
CHAI?
Clinton, I think it was... it was then called Clinton HIV-AIDS Initiative, right? That entity was illegally organized on March 24th, 2004. I don't think it... there's no evidence, and the Clinton Foundation has provided no evidence that it was ever authorized. They claimed that they merged it back into the parent. That was impossible to do as a matter of law. They operated it, and then it was operated from a home base in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but the Commonwealth of Massachusetts revoked its charter on March 31st, 2008. That's a matter of public record. You can see it for yourselves if you go to the Massachusetts online databases. And nonetheless, they, as you say, were soliciting money from governments, from the Gates Foundation, I think possibly from your government, and from people around the world. And as you say, they spent far more than they should have, and they diverted money away from intended programs. That right there is a series of crimes in Massachusetts, in the United States, around the world. The diversion of a restricted grant for an unauthorized purpose is a serious crime. And then to cover the record seems to show here, there are multiple different WikiLeaks cables and memos that seem to show that the reaction of the Clinton Foundation, instead of fessing up, was to say, why don't we cover this up by taking funds not out of an endowment, but it turns out there was something they were trying to call a quasi-endowment. Now, under U.S. law, there is no such thing. What this suggests is that monies were being directed towards the Clinton Foundation. They didn't land into the books. They were kept inside of a suspense account, and they took money out of this, what I would call a slush fund, and attempted to cover it up. Now, when you look in the books and records for this initiative for 2008, they're hidden on the Clinton Foundation site, the pages that would deal with this. But in New York, there's very strict rules. And the version of the, in quotes, audit that the Clinton Foundation submitted, it's not a legally compliant audit, but there's a schedule in the back that shows, ridiculously, that this entity's revenues were exactly equal to its costs, its assets were exactly equal to its liabilities in 2008. Now, in 2008, as we all remember, was a year of great turmoil around the world. This entity was operating all over the place. Currencies were rocketing up and down. Prices were rocketing up and down. There's no way in reality that the books and records would have matched off in that way, particularly given what you just talked about, the alleged diversion. And by the way, the memos that are out there claim that the CEO of this entity and the chairman of the entity confessed to the parent company that they had diverted this money. And then the memos claim, as Bill Clinton himself and others supposedly agreed, well, we'll patch this off. We'll cover it off by advancing monies we'd raised for another purpose. Now, when you raise money for an endowment in the United States of America, it is a strict rule that you must spend every penny that you raise only for that endowment. You can't take it in as an endowment, use it from some other purpose, and replace it later. But that's what they seem to have done. So that's a gross crime, confessed in these papers back and forth in 2008, yet covered up till just recently. And all the while, rather than fessing up and changing the books, inside this country, in every state, in Canada, around the world. They filed false and materially misleading reports around the world while they've been fundraising, using telephones, using the internet, using the mails. Down here, smaller versions of this, an $800,000 similar slush fund, has landed a sitting congressman, an African-American lady who's been in Congress for about 20-plus years, running for re-election this year. She faces 357 years in our federal prison for $800,000 in a smaller, shorter-lived set of frauds, alleged frauds. This is a big scandal.
We're talking about activities that seem to break the laws of charity, and I guess maybe you could explain what mechanisms have made it possible for the Clintons to escape legal scrutiny here.
Well, in the first instance, this is relatively complex stuff, and former presidents of the United States are given deference, whether they deserve it or not, inside the country and around the world. People are like, even I, when I got into this, thought, you know, I mean, I know Bill Clinton and the Clintons have, in some ways, a sketchy reputation, but I mean, this is a highly visible celebrity charity. Lots of people are looking at this. There are lots of regulators. So, you know, there's this natural, people are willing to suspend their cynicism and their disbelief and assume that, you know, that we're missing something and the books must be right. That's the first one. The second issue is that there never until now has been a case where a former president's wife has run for president, or spouse, I should say. So what one might argue the Clintons proved during their 8 years from 93 to 2001 is that they're bankable, that if you, you know, advance money to the Clintons, you might get many times that money back. So I think what happened here is that the people around the Clintons knew that Hillary would eventually run. And let's face it, around the world, I mean, in Canada, people are relatively straight. United States, actually, they were until recently relatively straight, but that's the exception in the global community. I mean, corruption is rampant around the world, and many, many leaders and prospective leaders are bankable. So money flowed towards the Clintons, and this thing has never had an audit, a legally compliant audit under our rules, even under your rules, it wouldn't pass. I mean, I'm not saying yours are any laxer. I'm just, your rules, our rules, any advanced economy's rules, this audit would never pass, and it's never really had an independent board. So it's never had controls. And then in our country, in the U.S., a lot of the regulatory apparatus, the names on the top of the door might be Democrat or Republican, but a lot of the worker bees inside all the regulatory agencies tend to be Democrats, as a story in the press demonstrated today, that 97% of the people who contributed in the Justice Department contributed to Hillary. So you've got a lot of people who are enthralled to the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. And if they're not enthralled to them, they're also, on the other side, enthralled to the Bush wing of the Republican Party, which, you know, in this charity has, let's just say, overlooked obvious crimes and cooperated on numerous ventures with the Bush family and the Clinton family in this charity.
They had some significant involvement in Haiti. After the earthquake, could you maybe speak to how the Clinton Foundation altered as a result of that, and the impacts on the Haitian people?
Sure. So actually, the Clintons got involved with in the name of the foundation in 2003, and that was primarily to do this HIV/AIDS work, without the requisite controls, without making sure that the medicines that went into Haiti were not, in fact, adulterated. So they started then. They may have dabbled in different economic development projects between then and 2008. In 2008, I think there was a hurricane, a series of hurricanes, and they got a little bit more involved in disaster relief in Haiti. Then in 2009, Bill was appointed special UN envoy to Haiti. And by January 12, 2010, there was the horrific earthquake. Bill immediately claims even now that he raised money for something called the Clinton Foundation Haiti Fund, and of course there is no such fund. In our country, you can't just say that you have a fund and not really organize it properly. It should be a legal entity, preferably a corporation. You need to file paperwork, and in particular in our country, you can't get involved in international charitable work unless it's truly charitable. You can't support a foreign government doing work that the foreign government should do. You need to do stuff that really is charitable and really is scrutinized and really is performed by people who are good people with an unblemished track record. So Bill didn't do that. He just started raising money in the name of his own foundation illegally. He did not file the proper paperwork in New York State where he was doing it from or in anywhere else. And then they teamed up with the Bush family and they created something called the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. And that's a small, relatively small enterprise. All in, it raised less than $100 million and spent less than $100 million. For some reason, that thing did claims, because it filed separately, that it has no foreign bank accounts. And, of course, the Haitian currency is not the U.S. dollar or the Canadian dollar. It's its own currency. I don't understand for the life of me how it could have operated in Haiti. In addition, there's some major league discrepancies in the paperwork. The parent claims that it sent $37 million down to the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. Sounds good, except that in the parent paperwork, they claim they sent it to a post office box in a state where the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund has never been organized, because it was always organized in Washington, D.C. That is a prima facie warning sign of fraud. The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, for some strange reason, spent very little of the money that it received in 2010, less than 20% of what it received, which again makes no sense in that the people were most desperate then. Now, the big issue and the one that should raise the hackles of people around the world and in Canada and in the United States is that Bill got involved using personnel of the foundation and the Haiti Fund and others, the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, with something called the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission. Now, that thing solicited anywhere, no one really knows, between $6 billion and $14 billion. Bill was co-chairman of it. The former Prime Minister, Bill Reeve, was the other co-chairman. They refused to account for any of the money that they have raised, which, you know, for the life of me, I don't get. I don't understand why there is not a multilateral oversight facility to oversee these international charities, because what ends up happening is the government of Canada thinks the government of the U.S. is regulating it. The government of Haiti doesn't really have an effective government. And this can be an excuse, and I think is an excuse, for billions of dollars to be raised and then get diverted. It seems that of the billions that they raised, money that intangible projects either went to a failed industrial park called Caracol or to a hotel project, neither of which were really in places that were damaged by the earthquake. So this is really, you know, there are a lot of well-meaning people around the planet who would like to help one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere and other poor countries. But again, this is a case study, it seems, of good intentions run amok with no regulation. On top of which, for a time, under Hillary's watch when she was Secretary of State, it seems the Haitian government decided to award a lucrative gold mining project to her brother. You know, and this is just despicable. I don't care whether you're, you know, apolitical, left-leaning, right-leaning. When people are flat on their backs, you don't put your boot on their necks and divert money from them.
What are the prospects that some kind of a legal mechanism could be brought forward either before or after Inauguration Day? Is an impeachment something that could be erected as a result of this fraudulent foundation work?
Absolutely. I actually would have a slightly different view. I think that if Hillary Clinton were to win, I think it's highly likely there would be a series of legal proceedings, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Were she to lose, an example will be made of this around the world. And you know, when you set up an international charity, and a charity in the U.S. operating internationally, you're vulnerable to all foreign laws. Our charities cannot break any law and still be a charity. So, you know, were a country like Canada or France or China or Russia interested in making an example of this, you would bring this thing to justice very quickly.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with our audience.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street banker who's been looking into the Clinton Foundation. You can find out more on his weekly blog exposing the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation at charlesortel.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. One rising social media star who has been doing her best to raise awareness of corruption within the Clinton campaign and within the media and political establishment generally is Debbie Lusignan, otherwise known as Sane Progressive. She's been monitoring the campaign for the Democratic nomination and has chronicled numerous instances of election fraud directed against the Bernie Sanders campaign. I got a chance to reach Debbie by Skype and asked her about the more egregious instances of rigging of the Democratic Party caucuses.
In the caucuses, they would inform people, they would tell Bernie Sanders supporters to leave before it was legitimate and their votes would be counted. Hillary Clinton's people and voters would leave and their votes would be counted. They were giving them wrong instructions. There was a lot of manipulation. We saw that in Iowa, and then it went on to Nevada, where we saw Harry Reid intervene. He had actually called casino bosses to let their employees go with paid days so that they could go and participate in the caucus. And we saw them streaming in. We have it on camera. They would go in to vote. They weren't even eligible voters to participate. So that was some of the things that happened with the caucus rigging. There was also, and I think one of the big red flags was electronic voting machines were being flipped. And how do we know this happened? Because this is not something you can see. Well, you look at the exit polls. And what we have with the exit polls is that they were not matching the official results. They did exit polls, in 11 of the 26 primary states, the Democratic primary states where they did the exit polls, they did not match the official results outside of the margin of error. And that happened in double digits. And people are like, well, what's that a big deal? It's just a poll. It's a very big deal. Because if we saw that happen in other countries, if the United States State Department saw that in other countries, and it's more than 2% a discrepancy between the official result and the exit poll, we won't consider those elections valid. But we had that happen in 11 of the 26 states where we did exit polls. And when this started to get traction in the news media, they canceled the last exit poll for California. So we had that happening. So it seemed like, and you know, also just common sense. Hillary Clinton was the front runner who couldn't fill a room. In California, we saw Bernie Sanders filling a stadium with tens of thousands of voters. At the same time, 2 weeks before, right before the California primary, when Bernie Sanders is having these tens of thousands of people in California, you are seeing Hillary Clinton. She can't fill a gymnasium. She has more people outside of the gymnasium protesting her, saying, "Drop out Hillary," then she has supporters coming to see her. So if you look at this, we saw this all over the country. Hillary Clinton, there's a photo gallery on the election fraud blog website. She can't, there's hardly anybody seeing her. Bernie Sanders is generating stadiums, and the media blacked it out. They wouldn't show those. So that was another piece of evidence. And we saw one of the most troubling things we saw, and we picked this up early on, is that people were being purged off the rolls or having their registration changed. And the main states we saw this in were Florida. Arizona was one of the worst. New York was one of the worst. California was one of the worst. And when we saw Arizona, we saw tens of thousands of people reporting that they had their registration either purged or it was flipped from Democrat, which they had registered for so they could participate in the primary, and it was flipped to Libertarian, Republican, lifelong Democrats were being flipped. So, you know, and this happened in New York. We know in Bernie Sanders' hometown of Brooklyn, 100,000 people were purged off the rolls. Two of the election state directors in that state had to step down for investigation both the Republican and the Democrat, so that we know. I mean, there is mass and objective evidence to prove this. The media would not report on it.
What about mechanisms like going to the state's attorney generals? Was there any action in that regard, and what was the response?
What we found for trying to get remedy on this, I live in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is one of the states where the exit polls were not matching the official results in double digits. I knew there was something wrong here. I was screenshotting the vote. I was watching the vote come in, and I was watching very irregular vote changes when election night was going down. And we would see in some precincts Hillary Clinton having 100%. The 100% of the vote would be reporting in some precincts, and Hillary Clinton would have 100% of the vote, and there would be nothing for Bernie Sanders. Unfortunately, what we have seen, the Clintons have been affiliated with the Democratic power, and the people who are the Secretary of States were mainly aligned with Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. They were very partisan. They actually actively worked to make it very, very difficult. In Massachusetts, Bill Clinton shut down our polling places. He did four different polling places. He was campaigning inside of, which is illegal, because of his security brigade. Some of the people in these precincts, they were closed all day long, and people couldn't vote. That was a form of voter suppression. And when we tried to get remedy for this, people brought a lawsuit for us. We were dismissed. We were mocked. It was collusion. It was collusion from a local, state, and national level.
What kind of response were you getting from the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Radio silence. I started covering this on my channel, and I was documenting, and I did it state to state to state. And so what would happen is I found is that we went through the election, I would have people contacting me because they had been trying to contact the Bernie Sanders campaign with very serious concerns. They had evidence. They had evidence of absentee ballot stuffing. They had information that they desperately wanted to get to the campaign. Nobody could get through to the campaign. I mean, nobody. So they would contact me thinking I might have an in because I talked about it so much, and I would call the campaign and I would try to call their lawyers. And people who were trying to get through to the campaign were desperately trying to contact me. They couldn't get through to the campaign. So the campaign was absolutely unreceptive to our concerns. I mean, I did everything. I wrote up a report to the Sanders that I had to send through their daughter-in-law back door. And that's how I eventually got some information. I never got a response from it. I had a petition with over 30,000 signatures, people desperately trying to get some answers of why Bernie Sanders wouldn't respond to this. I don't know if you saw my video in Philadelphia. I screamed to him outside of a Chili's, "Why didn't you address the election fraud, Senator Sanders?" As he walked by, he completely ignored me. I have met some, resistance with this because people love Bernie Sanders, but I'm sorry. He took $200 million from his supporters and he did not take basic action to protect the vote. And so, I've tried to hold him to account to that. I still have never received any answers from his campaign.
Now we're hearing Donald Trump essentially casting doubt on whether or not to accept the results of the election. In light of what you've just said, and for that matter, in light of what Hillary Clinton herself has said about supposed Russian interference in the election process, I'm wondering what kind of cognitive dissonance would allow Donald Trump or any other American to have complete faith in the election system.
It's really ludicrous and preposterous that the media is suggesting this. And it's really a trip to watch Hillary Clinton and her operatives go around, and they are purporting that foreign states, and they keep pointing to Russia, and I will tell you why that is such a load of crap in a minute. But they keep saying that our elections can be manipulated, that foreign state actors may interfere to rig the election results. And then they're saying, but our elections can't be rigged, so you can't look and challenge the results. Which is it? Either there is a real danger and that the results could be compromised, at which case both political candidates would want to make sure that they do everything to ensure an accurate accounting of the vote, or they can't be rigged. So it doesn't even make logical sense what they are saying themselves. But this isn't about logic. This is about manipulating the American people to go along with what this is not an election. This is a coronation. This is an installation of a queen is what we're seeing in this country. And it's absolutely absolutely an outrage.
Yeah, you're mentioning about the media distortion of this whole situation. I mean, there are a couple of things that come to mind. The use of polls to suggest that Hillary Clinton's way out in front and Jill Stein is somehow not even a factor. Could you talk about a little bit about polling, the use of polls, and other little mechanisms that are...
Absolutely. What we've been seeing in most major media polls being purported in the American corporate media is that Hillary Clinton is leading and that she has these margins. But when you look at the polling frames, invariably they are massively underrepresenting independent voters in these polls. Now, independent voters make up 43% of the registered voters in the United States. They make up a higher percentage than Republicans or Democrats. Yet a lot of these polls are polling independents at less than 18%. So that is absolutely that's a garbage polling frame right there. It puts the entire poll into question. And why would they under poll independents? Because Donald Trump leads in double digits with that group. So, you know, you can use polls to tell any story that you want if you know how to manipulate certain demographics. We saw it constantly with Bernie Sanders, where they were overweighting Hillary Clinton's top demographics, women, people over 50. They would really underrepresent millennials and independents when they were eligible to vote. And then they'd say, oh, my God, Hillary Clinton's winning. It's a game.
Yeah, it seems interesting that the Clinton campaign can seemingly getting a free ride talking about Russians hacking into the electoral system, but if somebody like yourself talks about the Clinton campaign doing an end run around Bernie Sanders or whatever, there's the term conspiracy theorist can come up.
I think there's something very serious people should be aware of. When we saw that the DNC, there was a leak, and we had the DNC emails from WikiLeaks, they were very quick to say that it was a hack and that it was by Russia. It's the same thing we saw with Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. CIA intelligence officials who won't go on record with their name, who refuse to talk about the actual evidence, do not provide definitive proof, and it gets repeated as a fact. And it is being repeated as a fact. And what is very dangerous about this is where this is coming from and where these talking points originated. Most people don't know when these talking points originated. When the DNC emails came out and the content exposed collusion with the DNC and the corporate media to sabotage Bernie Sanders' campaign for the goal of installing Hillary Clinton into the Democratic Party nomination, they desperately tried to make it about a source that they invented rather than the content that showed it was them who were interfering with a fair election on the ground. And what is most disturbing is right after that came out, there is a group called the Aspen Security Group, the Department of Homeland Security. And they issued a statement stating that Russia was involved and that we needed to put our elections under critical infrastructure, our cybersecurity of our elections under critical infrastructure, which immediately sent up a red flag for me. If you look at the signatories of where these talking points came out that you see the media parroting for the next 2 months, it is a group headed by Michael Chertoff and Michael Hayden, people who were involved in the NSA illegal spying program. And at the same time, they're coming out with these talking points saying it's Russia, we have to transfer oversight of cybersecurity of the elections. We have James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, saying we don't know who did these leaks. or if it was a hack. And we can't ascribe motive. But at the same time, this Department of Homeland Security group is coming out with the corporate media talking points, which became the narrative for the next 2 months. And they have, and they were seeking to put our elections under the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security through through the critical infrastructure clause, which is completely unconstitutional because, according to the Constitution, only the states have the power to execute elections, and the Congress has the authority to change how elections are implemented. So it's really chilling. And they have moved forward. They did not move forward to claim full jurisdiction of it through the through the critical infrastructure clause, but they have solicited 18 states to work with them. And they've created this election cybersecurity board, and the two co-chairs that they put on it, Alex Padilla of California and Brian Kemp of Georgia, are embroiled in election fraud lawsuits. So they're putting on the head of this cybersecurity over elections people who are embroiled in election fraud lawsuits and who have absolutely no experience with cybersecurity or encryption. It's really a red flag. We are going into one of those periods in American history that you always think of as historical, that, you know, this is like, you know, this was Cold War Russia. You know, this is communist China. This isn't how America is supposed to be. And we are understanding that our own government and our own leaders have turned against us. And it's going to take some time before the American people figure out how to respond to that. I tell my viewers, one of the ways that you can respond to that is, do not give power to anyone who oppresses you, regardless of the letter after the politician's name.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. But Debbie Lusignan, I want to thank you for sharing these thoughts with us. And hopefully our listeners will tune into your YouTube channel at The Sane Progressive. And
Sane Progressive. On Twitter, Sane Progressive. Facebook, Sane Progressive.
Okay. As well as your site, electionfraud2016.wordpress.com.
That's right.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
And as you're fond of saying, stay sane and peace out.
Peace out.
In 1992, when Bill Clinton first ran for the Democratic Party's nomination for president, he reportedly secured 75% of the black vote in the all-important primary voting day known as Super Tuesday. And in the 2008 primaries, Hillary Clinton reportedly outpolled her rival for the Democratic Party's nomination, Barack Obama, until Obama started winning primaries. And in this past year's Democratic Party primaries, during the crucial Super Tuesday battle, where 1 in 4 primary voters were black, exit polls reported about 8 in 10 black votes went to Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Yet many have pointed to the Clinton presidency's record in the 90s as evidence that America's first black president, as author Toni Morrison called him, was actually hostile to the welfare of the African-American community, or at least those facing economic hardship. So what is the key to the Clintons' apparent popularity within black America? To address this question, we are joined once again by Glenn Ford. He is an outspoken commentator and executive editor of Black Agenda Report, an online resource detailing news and analysis from the black left. Thank you very much for joining us, Glenn Ford.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, a bit of a fact check, if you will. What is the reality of how Clinton-era policies have impacted black Americans?
Well, it's been talked about a great deal that the Clinton regime hit the trifecta. It did away with welfare as we knew it, and thereby mounted an assault on black families and especially children that has not let up since. It introduced so-called anti-crime measures that made Bill Clinton the greatest incarcerator of black people in U.S. history. And in the final year of his presidency, they set loose the banks, deregulating them, leading to the greatest meltdown of this capitalist system since 1929, and the greatest loss of black wealth ever since emancipation. So, yes, the Clinton White House has been quite inimical to black interests. But, you know, Bill Clinton started out that way. Those who say that he is hostile to black interests are perfectly right. And we have to understand where Bill Clinton comes from. He and Al Gore were founders of the Democratic Leadership Council. The Democratic Leadership Council began as an organization based among white Democratic leaders in the South, who in the 1980s were facing a real crisis because of the steady attrition of white voters from the Democratic Party. And in the face of Jesse Jackson's two runs for president in 84 and 88, campaigns that were really huge black voter registration drives, the Democratic Party was becoming, in many precincts, a majority black party. And so Democrats, white Democrats like Al Gore and Bill Clinton, had a problem in maintaining their leadership of a party that was becoming increasingly black. And so they called upon big money to help them out, to bankroll their new organization, the Democratic Leadership Council, which they promised capital would work towards the diminution of black power within the Democratic Party and the power of unions. The DLC then became the corporate bag man in the Democratic Party, and Bill Clinton became the first DLC president. So he started off with an agenda, widely advertised, and funding that derived from that agenda to diminish the influence of black people in the Democratic Party.
How do you rationalize the active involvement of many black people in privileged positions supporting this, I guess, a backlash against that loss of white power within the party?
Well, I remember perfectly well when Bill Clinton became the champion in the eyes of some black people, and that was with Newt Gingrich's contract with America. This resurgence of white populist right-wing politics that was quite successful, and it seemed for a time that the barbarians were at the gate, and the only thing that stood between black folks and those barbarians was Bill Clinton, and that's how he developed this undeserved reputation as a defender of black folks. He parlayed that into a path that allowed him to destroy aid to families with dependent children, and then to introduce his omnibus crime bill. The assessment that he was the first black president was never shared by most black folks, but there was a general feeling that Bill Clinton stood between black folks and some white folks that were even more vicious.
Are the Clintons then effectively capitalizing on divisions within the black community?
Well, this is standard fare. He knows how to go to churches, and he taught his wife how to do the same, to appeal to those elements in the black community that want only that the white power structure recognize them and treat them politely. But there's a larger picture here that has to frame this entire situation, and that is the U.S. duopoly system. And in the U.S., the U.S. duopoly system is a double trap for black people. That is, when you only have two parties and both of them are controlled by the business classes, certainly it's a trap for everybody. But in the United States, in which a nation in which race is always central to politics, there has always been a white man's party. And this goes back to even before emancipation. And by a white man's party, I mean a party whose organizing principle is white supremacy. The Democrats were that party for most of the nation's life. And then after 64, really, not 68, the Republican Party became the white man's party. And so if you always have a white man's party, the duopoly system dictates that there's only one party for the black folks to be in, and that's the one whose organizing principle is not white supremacy. It doesn't mean that it's a black-friendly party, but it's not the party that is that organizes on the basis of white supremacy. So blacks are locked into this Democratic Party, and they therefore make decisions about who to support in the Democratic primaries based upon who they perceive will be the strongest candidate to defeat the white man's party. That is the main goal of participating in politics. And the strongest candidate, that is, the candidate that people perceive as being the strongest, is almost always the one with the most money, that is, the corporate candidate. So we see that in primary elections, black folks tend to support the more conservative candidate, the more corporate candidate, the richest candidate, in hopes that they'll beat the white man's party. Candidates that do not reflect the black political consensus, which is far to the left of the Democratic Party's center, but is a defensive mechanism to beat back the most reactionary party, the most racist party, the Republicans at the moment.
I see. Well, in that instance, I mean, I want to note that beyond the duopoly, there's been a lot of endorsements of Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka of the Green Party on your site. I'm wondering what, in your opinion, are realistic and actionable options available to the American public seeking justice and amelioration of the conditions affecting economically and racially marginalized Americans. I mean, you know, elections at the congressional level, civil disobedience. You know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, movement politics are, of course, the most important, and especially for black folks. Historically, that's been the case. And we've seen extraordinary, wonderful developments on the social movement front in terms of this emerging black-led movement that people describe as the umbrella term. And we've seen that black millennials are not wedded to the Democratic Party as their mothers and fathers and uncles and aunts are. And their ambivalence about the Democrats is what has Hillary Clinton's people most worried, if they have any worries at all about this election. That is the lack of enthusiasm among young black folks for the Democratic Party. That has not translated in huge numbers for the Green Party because black folks have no more access to information about the Green Party than white people, and in fact, probably a lot less. The blackout of the Greens is in some arenas almost total. But black folks do, especially young folks, want alternative electoral choices as well as showing a real enthusiasm for social movements.
Glenn, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you for appearing on the show and sharing your insights with us.
Well, thank you.
We've been speaking with Glenn Ford, who's based a writer and a broadcaster and executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. And he joins us from New Jersey. You can read more of his commentaries on the site blackagendareport.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour.
You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.